This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's jump right into our Week in Review, beginning with the just-released after-action report on the response to the Marathon bombing.
The state calls the overall response a great success, but says dozens of law enforcement agencies were poorly coordinated and that officers lacked weapons discipline.
Also this week, the growing controversy and disarray around Boston's Olympic bid, including fading public support and charges from Chairman John Fish that opponents to the Olympics are unpatriotic.
What bothers me a lot is the decline of pride, of patriotism, and love for our country.
Meanwhile, in Dorchester, police officers kill a black suspect, and the Boston police take an unprecedented and bold step to avert a crisis.
To see this was just really stunning for us. And when we saw the video, we understood why we were called in.
Plus, Senator Elizabeth Warren on the consequences of $1.3 trillion in student loan debt.
The set of loans from 2007 to 2012 are on target to make $66 billion in profit. That is obscene.
Joining us now to talk more about these stories and the rest of the week's news is Jim Sturgis. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute in Boston. Hello, Jim.
It's good to be with you.
Also with us is Dante Ramos, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hello there, Dante.
Great to be here. Hello.
So let's start with this after-action report. This afternoon, a state report examining the response to the Boston Marathon bombings released its long-awaited review. It contains some troubling conclusions about the police response to the attacks and the manhunt that followed. It also talked about what went well. It praised the extraordinary response by first responders, hospitals, and doctors. It pointed out that all the patients who were transported to hospitals survived. But the report also talked about poor coordination between thousands of police officers from scores of law enforcement agencies who descended on Watertown during the shootout with the Tsarnaev brothers and the search and eventual capture of Jahar Tsarnaev. It said that many of these officers came not because they were asked, but because they self-deployed, and that many of them exercised what the report called poor weapons discipline. So, Dante, I want to start with you. It sounds like a mixed report, the stuff about the poor weapons discipline, troubling. What did you make of this?
I think if you translate it from the bureaucraties, it's actually pretty damning. There are parts of it, certainly, that talk about the good response at the finish line and in the emergency rooms, and some of the things that they mention as lessons for the future in terms of not having enough tourniquets at the finish line. The lack of those things on Marathon Day in 2013 was a failure of imagination of some sorts. People just didn't necessarily imagine that what happened could happen. As far as the law enforcement part on what happened in Watertown, it really is quite troubling. You know, they use the phrase weapons discipline was lacking. What that means was that a lot of people were shooting and not fully knowing what was going on. Mm. And, of course, in that situation, there was an MBTA officer who got hurt. It's almost worse than what we knew, because one of the things that we learned is that the officers who self-deployed, as the report put it, parked every which way and in a way that kept an ambulance from getting out of the away from the firefight scene. So, you know, you look back on it and they're proclaiming that it's a big success, but there really was a real mix-up in Watertown. You assume that the officers, you know, wanted to be helpful, but there was clearly just no way of coordinating that.
You know, Jim, I want your comments on this, but just to give listeners an idea of what's in this report, I'm just going to read a little bit of it. Thousands of law enforcement officers arrived in Watertown from across Massachusetts, other New England states, and New York. Many of these law enforcement officers did not come in response to a mutual aid request, but self-deployed to the area once it became widely known that one of the Marathon bombing suspects was at large. Few were provided oversight, situational awareness, or guidance, while most officers did not deploy to the field. It goes on to basically say that essentially there was very little communication between these guys, and it led to some pretty hair-raising situations with live weapons in a densely populated area. Jim.
Look, the fact that they often didn't know what they were shooting at, the fact that when they got to the boat, one of the officers...
The boat where Jahar Tsarnaev was hiding, right?
Right,
yeah.
a gun goes off. It's from one of the officers, and then all of the officers start shooting at the boat, thinking that perhaps Tsarnaev is actually shooting at them. This is, it seems like a chaotically, almost organically forming posse that decomposes, and there's no sense of authority as to when people come and go. There's no command structure. There is a lot that's damning in the report. There's also a lot that's good. I would say there's one thing they have not looked at, which I really do think they should look at, and that is the whole home search aspect of this. I mean, there are dozens of people who took film on their phones when officers forcibly entered their homes without any warrants, without any reason per se, and just came in and actually arrested people in certain instances because those people were asking questions as to why they're entering their homes. That's another aspect of the response that I think we should be looking at, which is much more of a civil liberties one. I understand it's not as maybe doesn't rise to the level of we shot an MBTA officer. Yeah. We could hurt people, really. We shot at officers in a black pickup truck, not knowing who they were. This is something, you know, it needs a much deeper look. And I would agree with Dante that this is a pretty damning report when you put it all together.
Dante, a while back, your paper called for a full assessment, an accounting of what went well and what didn't go so well in the wake of the bombing. Not necessarily to get people in trouble, but just to learn lessons that have to be learned. Does this report satisfy that call?
It satisfies it to some degree. Thinking back, one of the concerns that we had voiced at the time was also the Tadashev shooting in Florida, which there's subsequently been some information that came out about also. But, I mean, the one thing I would say about this report is it still, despite everything that I mentioned and everything that Jim just mentioned, it still does play it a little bit cute in terms of things that were obvious mistakes by law enforcement. You know, it doesn't, I think, come out and say exactly how the state police and Boston police officer who were riding in a Massachusetts state police pickup truck came to be shot at, but one presumes that that was an officer. The fact that up to this point, you know, it hasn't been definitively said who exactly shot the MBTA transit officer. You know, I think we can conclude from that. And I think, you know, this is a situation where people in law enforcement are really, I think, sincerely responding to something that was really, you know, we all remember that week, a real sense of crisis. But there were people who got hurt, and those people were, you know, one of those people was a law enforcement officer. And just for the sake of, you know, promoting safety within that profession, you want to see a more kind of direct acknowledgement of what all went wrong.
Well, let's move on, if we can, to actually another law enforcement story, but this has to do with innovation and a change in a previous tactic that Boston police have taken. Because late last week, Officer John Moynihan made a routine stop, a traffic stop in Roxbury. He ended up getting shot in the face and seriously wounded by the man who he had stopped, one Angelo West. Angelo West was then shot and killed by other officers who arrived on the scene. So you can imagine that this presented, you know, possibly a lot of unrest or potential for unrest in the neighborhood where this happened. But Boston police took the rare step and showed surveillance video of the shooting immediately or the day after to community leaders in an effort to forestall the kind of unrest that we've seen, of course, in places like Ferguson, Missouri. So here's Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans explaining why he decided to release the video.
We were in contact with them, almost all of them at the scene, just letting them know what we had and trying to walk them through. Because we've learned, you know, it's important to build all our community leaders and sort of all get the same message. We didn't want the city to sort of, you know, get the wrong message.
Now, one of those community leaders was the Reverend Jeffrey Brown. He told us on this program yesterday that Boston Police's decision will set a precedent on how to handle future shootings.
When another one of these shootings occurs, there's going to be the expectation that if there is video footage, that that video footage be shown to the leadership. So we're in that age now where a year of painstaking, you know, research is not suffice because it just continues to churn the rumor mill and divide communities.
Yeah, you know, and this. So Dante, that's me talking over myself. Forgive me. I couldn't wait for the Reverend Brown to be finished. But Dante, you wrote a really great piece about this in the Globe. And one of the questions that that you raise and we also come away with is, and this is one case in which the incident was rather cut and dry. I mean, Bill Evans himself said he didn't feel like the police had anything to hide. But what happens in cases where it's less clear. I mean, he's now set a precedent of releasing video very quickly after the fact.
I think, as Reverend Brown says, it does create an expectation, and it would be very difficult for them to withhold video evidence, again, if it exists in the future. The one thing I would say that is probably a mitigating factor here for police who are concerned about the precedent that it might set is, you know, fortunately in Boston, this doesn't really happen all the time. So it's not as though there are, you know, every week there's some kind of incident like this. But I think increasingly we will expect that there is going to exist video of things that happen, just because there's a lot more video everywhere of everything. And, you know, I think in this case, Commissioner Evans had thought through the benefits of sharing the video. And from my discussion with him before writing that column, you know, he seems open to the idea of transparency in future situations. I think he stopped short of saying categorically in every possible situation they would release it. But I think, you know, he didn't do this cluelessly. He understands that this expectation will exist in the future.
Mm. Now, Jim, I mean, we also recognize the fact that this is, you know, basically unprecedented because there's still an active investigation into what happened going on. You know, is there any concerns, do you think, about police releasing this is video evidence as well in advance of the completion of an investigation? Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, look, the swift response, I think, was remarkable. I thought it was actually really thoughtful to do it, and I think it helped us to prevent a Ferguson-like backlash, right? So those are all good things. But when you're setting a precedent, you have to think about what the future looks like, and I think, look, what happens if it's a more complicated situation and the police, in order to understand how they might be able to make sure there's not a violent backlash, they decide to hold a video for a week? The innuendo and rumor mill starts immediately. What if there's no video? In reality, no video, but the community doesn't believe that, right? That's a really tough place for the police to be as well. And, you know, the other part of it is, what if you're not involved in the crime, but you just happen to be there as a bystander or something? How do you protect privacy in those situations? So those are the things that come to my mind, and I think we're able to deal with them. I guess what it says to me is this: there is mistrust between the community and the police for many reasons. This can be helpful, but it can also be harmful. And the basic issue is we need to build trust in the community. And that means much more police presence, community building, and, you know, talking to folks. That there's no replacement for that. And body cameras will never replace that.
So, yeah, go ahead, Dante.
Well, what I would say, too, is I think, you know, on the upside, this very move is part of developing the kind of rapport between police and community that Jim mentions. One distinction that I think that listeners should understand is that they didn't come out immediately and put the video on the internet. There was a selection of community leaders who, you know, the commissioner and others around him knew well and, you know, thought to be influential in the broader community that they invited in to screen the video. So, you know, it wasn't a direct public release, which could have sort of more complicated consequences. You know, they went to people who they thought would be helpful in spreading the word around the community without necessarily disseminating it broadly. And that may be a model for future interactions also.
Mm. Well, let's move on and talk about Senator Elizabeth Warren yesterday at UMass Boston, where she went to talk about the heavy weight of student loan debt. Across the country, students owe $1.3 trillion in student loans. More than a million people have fallen behind on their payments in just the past year. And all this, according to Warren, helping the federal government to reap $66 billion in profits. So she wants to, she has tried unsuccessfully to push an amendment through the Senate that would allow many students to refinance their loans and cut their interest rates from as high as 10% in some cases to less than 4%. Here's what she told us yesterday.
So what I propose is to reduce the interest rate on student loans, wipe out those profits for the federal government, and give our kids a fighting chance to pay off their debt.
Jim, I'll start with you. What do you make of Senator Warren's call to cut the interest rate on student loans, even though she hasn't figured out a way to get that through the Senate?
All right. Well, I think a lot about this. My daughter's about to go to college, so I'm thinking about how much debt she's going to incur. So, you know, her proposal to cut rates from 10 to somewhere around 4 makes some sense, especially in the short term. In the long term, I have have all kinds of questions about. I mean, remember back in 2010, we had a move away from guaranteed privately originating loans to federally backed loans directly in order to cut out private profits. Now the government's profiting from this, but they're only profiting from this in the short term because what they're doing is they're lending out money on short-term rates over a longer period of time. So there's a differential there, and they're banking that. That's going to flip. And so the long-term prospect for this is not great as far as a successful strategy. There are other ones that we could actually look at in terms of extending the duration of loans and things like that. My problem with it, to be really precise, is it doesn't deal with the underlying causes. Look, in 2000, there were about 6 million fewer kids who were going to college than there were in 2014. Demand is high. That pushes up prices, right? That's what happens in every single market. The second thing is the rise in tuition that she's talking about when she talks about more public funding for higher education. That flows to public institutions. There are many, many private institutions out there, and those kids are also incurring loans. And I'd say the last thing is there's a cost structure issue here with our higher education system. Anyone who takes a look at salary lists for state employees knows that the top paid folks for hundreds of employees are in the state universities and colleges. So there's much more to this question than just, hey, can we make it easier for them? All that said, if we can not have the federal government make money off our backs, I'm all for it.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because if you talk about, a good deal on student loans makes it easier for kids to go to college. That's a good thing. Ironically, it creates more demand at these colleges and could actually contribute to driving the prices up. Mm-hmm. Yep. Dante, chime in on this one. What's your view about what Warren's approach or tactics, what you think of the issue?
Well, Anthony, I was about to say precisely what you just said, which is that, you know, we've had very conscientious efforts to extend access to college, but one of the kind of negative downsides of it is that it reduces the downside for universities to push up tuition. And, you know, the situation is evolving where, you know, a lot of people just end up taking on a lot more debt than they otherwise would have. And reducing the rates, again, allows them to take on a larger principal to begin with. So, you know, it's a complicated issue. I think, you know, an overarching issue for Senator Warren has been, you know, she sort of puts the problem out there, you know, without necessarily a precise solution. And there's an element of theater to it. I will say that depending upon your public policy preferences, it is a useful kind of theater in the sense that if you're concerned about, you know, aspects of inequality in the economy, the fact that there are middle class families or working class families that are having trouble with education is something that it's easy for the public policy system to kind of ignore because there's no easy answer to it. And simply by, you know, reminding people that the problem exists and that there's a sort of, you know, obvious inequality or inequity that's there is, you know, maybe worth doing on its own terms.
Well, gentlemen, I just want to get one last topic in here before we're done for the day, and that is Boston's troubled Olympics bid. A week can't go by without us talking about this. This week, Barb started flying over who is to blame for the lackluster support around town for Boston's bid. Mayor Marty Walsh said just yesterday, it's just bad press.
Once a conversation is allowed to happen around the bid and around what it means to bring Olympics in, that's a good thing. The negativity in Olympics isn't based on actually the Olympics itself. It's been all of the surrounding stories, whether it's been the ballot question or the transparency question around the salaries.
Okay, Jim, I've got to ask you. So Marty Walsh saying it's bad press, but then again, we also at the top of the show heard John Fish saying people opposing the Olympics are unpatriotic. Is that bad press, too, or is there a major PR problem here?
Well, you know, I actually think there's more than a PR problem. And I know that in The Globe today, there was an article by Shirley Leung talking about Doug Rubin. So it's kind of past the blame time in this game that we're playing here. I don't really think it has that much to do with John Fish either. I think it has to do with trust. And I think the trust was broken at a critical moment this, you know, January and February, where they came out, the Olympic Committee, that is, came out and said, look, all the transportation projects, they're kind of paid for. Don't you worry about it. And then immediately we went into T-land. That's not their fault, but the T took us into a different mind space, if you will. We're sick of standing out on platforms waiting in the really cold and actually not having servers or having an open city for weeks on end. That just broke the back of trust. And to build that back up is a real painstaking organizational problem, PR problem, to be true. But it's all kind of, that's all sort of a sideshow. I think we've broken the trust. I think that if they go after a popular referendum, there is perhaps time to build that back up. I actually doubt it. And I'm not against the Olympics, per se. I'm just looking at this as an objective observer from the outside. I think it's really hard for them to build that trust.
So, Dante, do you feel the same way? Is this downward slide going to be hard to break?
I think it's difficult to break for a particular reason. I don't think it's impossible. I think that the fact that they haven't really done a great job of selling the upside of this means that, you know, they could potentially still do it. I will say that one of the things that I think has gone wrong is that they're playing a multi-dimensional chess game here, because there's the venues that they have to plan, and each of those is a, you know, actual big thing, and it's the kind of development issue that we end up fighting over each one individually in a normal situation with people, neighbors would end up fighting about for years. So multiply that times X number of venues, you've got that. Then you've got the